Hey everyone, this is Graham from Guru Focus. If you haven't met me already, I run our Value Investing Live series on YouTube. The podcast you're about to listen to was originally recorded live in front of an audience, so our guests may make references to charts and PowerPoint slides that you won't be able to see here. If you want to check out their full presentation, including those slides, or join our next live stream, click on the link down in the description. Now back to the podcast. All righty. Welcome, everyone, to Value Investing Live. I am pleased to welcome our guest this week, Jeff Stacey, the founder of Stacey Muirhead Capital Management. Jeff has over 35 years of investment industry experience and is also a chartered financial analyst here. As always, for those of you out in the audience, please post those questions and comments throughout the live stream. Let Jeff know what you're thinking, what's going on. Say hello, as Mike is doing in the chat already. He's on top of things as per usual. Let us know where you're viewing from. We love to see those international audience members out there. And do please keep in mind, those questions are going to come at the end of things. So as more questions pile up, just keep in mind, we do have to cruise through those earlier ones before we get to the later ones. So stick around. We will get to your question today. Without anything further from me, I'll go ahead and hand things over to Jeff. We can go ahead and jump into the presentation.
Well, thank you, Graham. And it's a pleasure to be with Guru Focus today and look forward to questions later on. Let me just start by saying I'm a huge fan of Guru Focus and subscribe and use the platform myself. And we were just briefly talking before we went live that, you know, every time you go on the platform, you discover something new and a new way to use it. And so I'm a huge fan and I'm just delighted to be here. Before we get into the nitty-gritty of things, I would just throw up a disclaimer. Certainly, I'm going to be making some forward-looking comments, particularly when we get to the investment section, and just want to make you aware of that. But start perhaps with some background on me and Stacey Muirhead Capital Management. And as I was thinking about pulling this together, I thought maybe I would just highlight some of the key events or influences that have guided me and informed me on my journey over the last 35 years as an investor. So I'll start just talk about an early exposure to investing. My father ran his own business that had a company pension plan for its employees. And one of my first exposures was, you know, the annual reports for all the companies that were owned in the pension plan would come into my father, and he'd pile them up in a corner and he would read them when he got a chance. But that was really an early exposure for me and really tweaked my interest. I'm not sure at that age that I really understood what I was looking at, but it always stuck with me that reading annual reports and that process of discovery and investigation just resonated with me. And then, you know, going on, I mean, in terms of educational background, I have a business degree and my CFA charter, as Graham alluded to earlier, started Stacey Muirhead in 1994. So we've been around a while. Just thought maybe I'd talk to you about structure considerations, because this is something that comes up when people phone me who are talking about starting an investment management firm. And so I would just say, I tried to create a firm that was really intended to invest my own and my family's capital. And so everything that we did was guided off of that. You know, how do we want to invest? And then, you know, obviously we were, I hoped to attract clients who thought of the world similarly to how we were trying to invest for our family. But there's, I guess I would just say, you know, there's any different type of model that can work in the investment business. But I think it's really, really important to assess what you want and what your strengths and your guiding principles are and your organizational strengths, and then attempt to build a firm consistent with that. So, you know, we don't have a broad suite of investment offerings at our firm. We've stuck to our knitting, as the old expression goes, and tried to really practice the craft that way. I didn't want to be part of a large team. I'm not saying that can't work in the investment business. There's lots of examples where that can work. But, you know, I just wanted a really small group of people and almost to be engaging in the investment process independently. And, you know, I just to strike an example of that, I think it's interesting that, you know, as large as Berkshire Hathaway's become, you know, Warren and Charlie worked quite independently and separately. And now that Ted Weschler and Todd Combs have come on board, you know, Warren Buffett has publicly stated that, you know, he doesn't have investment committee meetings or anything like that. And, you know, Todd and Ted work independently. And so that was something that really appealed to me. And I thought that was an important part of the consideration of how we structured our firm. And then I would just say, you know, this is really important for startups. And, you know, I often get asked about, oh, I just, you know, I my life is investing. I'd really like to start up an investment firm, and I don't want to do all the other things. I just want to invest. And, you know, yes, that was certainly my view of it when I started up as well. But I think you just have to be thinking about, you know, how are you going to deal with clients? How are you going to deal with particularly the regulatory and compliance structures? And even for people who say, well, I'm going to get an administrator, which can be a valued, important way to operate, you just can never divorce yourself from all the facets of running the business. So I would just say it's important to think about those things. Colleagues, I just want to comment, you know, I'm blessed to work with two really wonderful people here at Stacy Muirhead, my colleagues Mark Emer and Rosalie Grosbean, and, you know, they're just incredibly talented people. They're smart, they're hardworking, they have integrity, and, you know, we try to have fun around the office and have a few laughs, and I just think that's really important. So then one of the other influences, I just have put the phrase networks here, and I view this in two ways, both networks of friends and networks of mentors. And I've been blessed, I'll talk the friend side first. You know, I've been blessed to have a number of investment colleague friends, if you will, over the years. And, you know, when you name names, you always risk missing somebody important. But, you know, certainly have been longtime friends with, you know, Tom Russo, who I know has been on Value Investing Live before, Tom Gaynor at Markel, you know, Prem Watts has been both a great friend and a mentor to me. And so I've been, you know, really, really blessed to have a lot of friends in the business that have helped me. And we've had vigorous debates about both specific companies or about process, about what makes a great investment. And it's really wonderful on a personal level, but it's also extremely helpful to ensuring success over the long term. And then on the mentor side, I mean, I won't claim that you know, we all have the same, or most of us, I think, would have the same mentors. Obviously, I've been a long time attender at the Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting. Went for 28 straight years prior to COVID, when we were all forced to go online the last couple of years. But enormous benefits from those meetings. So Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger have been great influencers. Peter Lynch has been a great influencer. I know Charlie in his book talked about the importance of Peter Lynch and I echo that. Sir John Templeton's been an enormous influence and mentor to me, and certainly salute the work that Lauren Templeton's done to continue to proselytize and for her great uncle, Sir John Templeton, and he was just a terrific investor. So, importance of networks, both friends and mentors. Importance of alignment with investors. And, you know, I alluded a little bit to this with our structure considerations, but, you know, everything that we've done in terms of attracting investors is just about ensuring that we have like-minded investors with us. The investment business is competitive. It's hard. There's going to be periods where you're underperforming, and it's really important that you have long-term buy-in from your investors. And I think the biggest way to ensure that is just the old-fashioned golden rule. You know, I would try to treat our investors and provide the information that I would want if the roles were reversed. So really, really important. And then perhaps, if you'll permit me to explain, this may seem a little unusual, but the ability to detach and recharge. And certainly the investment business is really competitive, and you can't cheat the craft in any way. To be good at it, you have to be intense and relentless spend the time and make the effort. But I think people who are one-dimensional in the investment business sometimes lose their way as well, and it's important to step back. And everybody will have their own way of detaching and recharging, so I'm not suggesting that my way is the right way or the only way, but I would just say in my case, you know, the importance of family and friends and, you know, trying to do what I can from a fitness perspective, and we can all do better, but try to keep fit. And certainly am a big hiker, like to read. I like to travel, although that's obviously been constrained the last few years, given the situation we've been going through. And then my own personal oddity, if you will, is I play the drums and enjoy that as an escape. And strangely enough, there's a lot of mathematics involved in drumming that may have some alignment with the investment process. So that's it for background. Let me talk real quickly to our investment philosophy, and I'll just say there's a lot that's pretty common and not unusual, and you will have heard other investors at large or that have spoken in this forum use similar types of language to describe their investment philosophy. But I would say there's three main aspects to, you know, what is the essence of the Stacy Muirhead way. First one, I think we're unconstrained. So what I mean by that is we can buy small companies, we can buy large companies, we can look up and down the capital structure. If it makes sense to buy the bonds instead of the common, we certainly are willing to look at that. You know, we can buy any industry, we can buy, you know, any sector. The other piece that's related to that is we're trying to be global. Currently, we have holdings in, I believe, 11 or 12 countries around the world. In our efforts to be global, I describe that as evolutionary. I mean, I would be misrepresenting my capabilities or the capabilities of Stacy Muirhead if I said, you know, yeah, we can go anywhere in the world and we can evaluate any security anywhere in the world. But, you know, over time, we keep pushing out, and certainly it's a goal of ours. I think it's safe to say we feel very comfortable in North America and Europe, but we currently have some exposure in Africa and one exposure in China, and we also have an exposure in India, and so year by year, we're thinking about that, and we're trying to get better at being global practitioners. And then the last comment I would make, and I've chosen this phraseology very deliberately, we're valuation driven. And I think the investment business has done itself a disservice by this incessant debate over the last decade about growth versus value. And yes, we certainly would call ourselves value investors if asked. But, you know, we're just trying to buy companies that where we can appraise what we think fair value is. And of course, we hope that fair value continues to grow over time. And then we're trying to buy those companies with a margin of safety or at a discount. And we don't distinguish between, you know, some of these measures of growth and value. We look at a lot of ways to value a company. And just kind of a related term, I think, you know, the world continues to evolve. And, you know, there's been debate about, you know, how some of the disruptive technology models that are out there. And you know, I guess from my chair, we're willing to look at anything as long as we can develop some notion of what we think that is worth. And, you know, that can be on the come. It doesn't mean that a company needs to be necessarily profitable today, but I will sound the caution that the further out you go, the more certainty you better have about the ending point. And I do think that perhaps some investors have embraced, you know, this world of disruption and innovation. And, you know, I think from my chair, a lot of these new style investors, I mean, it's the too hard pile for me. And I just don't have the certainty that perhaps others have. But I think it's really important just to have an open mind and say, you know, we're willing to look at anything as long as we feel comfortable, we can understand the valuation, and we can buy at a discount. We don't necessarily view ourselves as you got to buy below book or less than 10 times earnings or this cash flow multiple. You know, we think it's just important to frame it in terms of this notion of intrinsic value and this notion of a margin of safety or purchasing at a discount. So there's really four buckets in which we tend to operate. Two being the most important and two being kind of residual effects. And so I would just, we make long-term investments, and I'll talk more to that, but this is not dissimilar to what you would hear from others that have come on these presentations in the past. We also do event-driven investing, and I'm going to define that in more detail in a moment. But we consider these two activities kind of the cornerstones of what we do and the lion's share of what we do. But then, just to be clear, we also talk about other commitments. And we're just saying we're willing to be flexible and opportunistic and look at other things that don't neatly fit into the long-term investment bucket or the event-driven bucket. And then we're also not afraid to let our cash build up if we have more capital than good ideas. And I think there's a really subtle but important distinction that I would like to make on that front as well. Cash is not an active market timing call in any way. We're bottom-up stock pickers, and, you know, we just try to find ideas, but if we can't, rather than lower our standards, we certainly will leave money in cash rather than lower standards. We make enough mistakes even when we think we're not lowering our standards. So, you know, and then I guess I would just say, to me, you know, we're stock pickers. You know, fundamental research and stock picking are the cornerstone, and you know, I'm sure we've fallen short many times, but you know, my goal is simple. I want to know more about the company that we're investing in than anybody else. And I'm sure we've fallen short on many, many occasions, but it's just a rigorous, fundamental research and stock picking approach that is the essence of everything that we do. So let's talk really quickly to long-term investments. And, you know, you've heard this from other investors in the past, but, you know, we really try to think about it three main ways. Does the business we're looking at or considering or investing in, does it have outstanding business economics? Does it have honest and capable management? And then is it available and can it be purchased at an attractive price? And just, you know, anachronism that others have used, you know, is just we're looking for a great business run by great people that's available at a great price. Okay, let's try and break that down a little bit. So does it possess outstanding economics? And I'm just going to rip through a bunch of the things that we look for. I'm not saying this is an all-inclusive list, but I think it'll give you a flavor for what we're about. High returns on shareholder capital. You know, we want good balance sheets, strong balance sheet with minimal or no debt or net cash after debt. That's something that we look for. And I'm sure, like others, mistakes we have made have often involved too much debt and a company getting in trouble. Attractive operating and profit margins, and hopefully they're going up over time, but just good margin levels. You know, we look not exclusively so, but sometimes significant brand recognition can be something that you know helps. We're Diageo shareholders, for example, you know, and certainly a broad portfolio of brands is part of the valuation that goes into Diageo. Pricing power for products. Just signal a very quick sidebar, whether inflation is transitory or not. I will sidestep that whole debate that's going on right now. But, you know, the best way to protect yourself is to have companies where they can increase the prices for the goods or services that they're selling in response to input cost increases themselves. And we certainly have tried to emphasize that in our investing. I'm sure that we've fallen short on occasion or misjudged, but I think especially if we are in a sustained inflationary environment from here, that will be of ever increasing importance in terms of how we think about our investments. You know, obviously growing revenue and earnings over time, and nothing is straight up, and certainly, but you kind of want that trend over time to be upward, and you know, consistent free cash flow generation. And for sure, that is an open debate for investors when you look at free cash flow or owner earnings or however you define that. You know, the million-dollar question is how much CapEx is required to maintain the business in its existing format. And I don't profess any particular insight on that, but it's something you try to think about. So that's some outstanding business economics, honest and capable management. Excuse me. I would just say, you know, big part for us is skin in the game. We really want to see our managers have equity ownership on the same basis as us. Of course, we look for reasonable compensation practices. Where there's pay for performance, we want that to be measurable and tied to something that you can get some sense as to whether management is in fact, you know, creating value on a pay for performance basis. Obviously, demonstrated integrity above all else. You know, Tom Gaynor tells the story about if you have someone who's, you know, capable and really smart, but doesn't have integrity, they will end up with a disproportionate share of the rewards. And certainly, I agree with that. We look for a capital allocation record, certainly. And then unique corporate culture. And I would just say, the more time I spend in the investment business, the investments we've had that have been the most successful, there is a definable difference. And, the first part of culture is cult. And at the risk of, there can be lots of negative things associated with the word cult, and rightfully so. But I just have found, really successful businesses, there's a real definable culture that you can feel when you go there and when you visit. And that's we're looking for that in our investments. And then, around price, I don't have any magic tool that nobody else is using. We're looking at the same ratios, price earnings, price cash flow, price to free cash flow, dividend yields, all the same thing that everybody else is looking at. We're looking at a discounted cash flow model. And I would just say, DCFs can be, full of error because, the inputs are wrong, but it is the right way to think about the business. So this is a quote from Warren Buffett that's resonated with me over the years. And there's many others, but this one in particular, your goal as an investor should be simply to purchase at a rational price, a part interest in an easily understood business whose earnings are virtually certain to be materially higher 5, 10, or 20 years from now. So that's long-term investments. I'll just talk really quickly to event-driven investments, and then we can move on to some of our portfolio holdings and then get to your questions. What is it? What are event-driven investments? And it's pursuit of profit from announced corporate events. So mergers, recapitalizations, spin-offs, liquidations, reorgs, self-tender offers, and common to every event-driven investment is your evaluations based on four questions. And I didn't make these questions up. You can go back and read other practitioners, and certainly Warren Buffett articulated these in a past Berkshire Hathaway annual report. But, what is the probability of this event occurring? How much time is it going to take? And then, the upside downside question, what's the possibility or probability that something better can happen? And what happens if this event doesn't take place? And so, the obvious one there is lack of financing, perhaps for a takeover or regulatory hurdles that can't be met. But, every event-driven transaction comes down to making an assessment on those four questions. And I would just comment, we expect to profit regardless of the behavior of the stock market in most circumstances. So what we like about event-driven investing is, yes, you can make mistakes in event-driven investing as well, but, it's on its own cycle, separate from whether the stock market is up or down 1,000 points. It has its own cycle. And so, while nothing's guaranteed, and yes, we can make mistakes too, we like this idea that event-driven is generating good rates of return in its own right, but it has its own cycle, separate from normal long-term investing or stock market investing. So that's event-driven. I just will end my formal comments before we get to questions. I was thinking as I was preparing for this, do I go deep on a single name, or do I talk about, a bunch of holdings in our portfolio? So I've put up 8 different holdings that are currently part of our portfolio. I'll defer discussion on Berkshire Hathaway. I think it's a well talked about company, and Graham, I think most of your listeners probably have at least some familiarity with Berkshire, so I'll defer on that. We own shares in Fairfax Financial and Markel, two well-known property and casualty insurance companies. You know, that the while there are certainly differences between both companies, I think the thing that you have today in the insurance business is just a hard market for property and casualty insurance underwriting. So that's a very favorable backdrop for both of those companies, increased underwriting profits. And then they are both exceptional investors in their own right. And again, differences between them and how they invest. You know, I'll just make a comment about Fairfax right at the moment with Fairfax. You know, it trades at a dramatically lower valuation than either Berkshire or Markel. But yet over the long run, their track records have been pretty similar. Although obviously Berkshire's been around longer, but just looking at the compounds of book value or market price, you know, they're pretty similar. And, you know, I concur with comments that Warren Buffett's made, that Tom Gaynor's made at Markel, that book value's, you know, becoming less relevant to all three of these companies as a valuation measure. But certainly it's not... It's not an unuseful measure of valuation. And so Fairfax, as we speak, trades at about 75 to 80% of book, depending on what price we're using. And in Berkshire Hathaway and Markel are about 1.5 times book. So real disparity. But yet, I would comment that, you know, last year during the pandemic, Prem Watsa, the CEO, who was already the controlling shareholder, purchased $150 million U.S. dollars worth of additional shares in the open market. And currently, Fairfax has a tender offer for up to $1 billion and a range. Obviously, it's a modified Dutch tender, but a range on prices that they're willing to buy back up to $1 billion worth of stock. So if that doesn't mean they're right, but clearly the proof is in the pudding that they think Fairfax shares are quite undervalued. So then second row, just Fairfax India would comment. So it's a subsidiary of Fairfax with a public stub and a direct exposure to India. Also think it's very cheap. Mr. Cooper Group, which I highlight as an example. I'm not saying it's a micro cap or really small cap company, but it's certainly not a large company either. But it's the largest non-bank servicer of residential mortgages in the United States and the fourth largest overall. High returns on tangible capital, significant portfolio of mortgages that they're servicing, you know, $668 billion in what's called UPB, unpaid balance. Of mortgages, huge opportunities. Most of their customers could benefit from refinancing at today's lower interest rates. So there's lots of opportunity in front of them. Think it's just a wonderful company that's done extraordinarily well. And then across the bottom, I just have examples of event-driven investments for you, and happy to talk to any of those. Garrett was a spinoff from Honeywell, that also became a bankruptcy reorganization candidate. But I'll just say, you know, we probably in some ways were in error when we participated as a spinoff, but we added to our position in the bankruptcy and it's working out very well for us. Nuance is a software company being taken over by Microsoft, and Casper Sleep, the betting company that's being taken over by Durational Capital Management. And just using today's numbers, you know, you're setting up about a 20% annualized rate of return in Casper if this transaction closes as contemplated by the end of the first quarter in 2022. So, Graham, I'll maybe stop here and we can open it up to questions, but please to go a little deeper on any of these names or if anyone has an interest. I just wanted to give you a flavor for some of our investments.
All right. Well, we definitely do have some questions built up here for us, Jeff. Before we actually jump into the questions coming in from chat, and this may be a surprise to you, for those of you here in our chat today, we did actually post a article on Guru Focus calling for questions late last week. We do have a couple built up here. We're going to start off there and then we'll jump into those chat questions. So those of you out in the audience, keep an eye out for these articles on Guru Focus. If you want to get those early questions in and truly kind of guarantee your questions to get asked here, we're going to start with these in the future. So keep an eye out for those articles. Questions here coming from Blaine though, and he's joining us hopefully here in the stream today. But if not, he's from Georgia saying hey. But he wants to start off with the question of what type of public companies would university endowments look for? If you have any thoughts there.
I'll kind of sidestep the question just slightly. Because in my background, I've been involved on investment committees for two universities here in Canada. Typically, the way the universities that I have been involved with, we're focusing on selecting managers to which we allocate capital, and less so on direct equity investments. Now, I do know some of the very large endowments do make direct investments, but certainly the ones I was involved with didn't. And I think, you know, again, you know, just sidestepping the, you know, I talked earlier about this growth value paradigm and, you know, how much attention it gets. I will only speak to our experience, you know, at the two universities I was involved with. The biggest thing that we looked for in managers was certainly a good long-term track record with a consistent process and the same people that created the track record still actively involved. But, you know, we really looked at, we always thought there were different ways to be successful and different ways to go about it. But, you know, we really looked for a process that was applied rigorously and consistently and where the investment managers didn't deviate from that. And so that was the way we went about it. Now, it won't surprise you. I mean, certainly we looked managers in many cases that had the same types of approach on long-term investments. So, you know, we're investing in high return on capital investments with minimal debt and so on a look-through basis. We would sometimes consider or try and do a deep dive on portfolios of managers, but we didn't actively manage that. So, I know that's not exactly the question that was asked, but I hope that gives you a flavor from, you know, my experience. And I'm not saying others other institutions haven't behaved differently, but certainly the two that I was involved with, that was how they went about the process.
Definitely. I think that's a good all-encompassing answer without trying to dive too specifically here on this question here. Another question from Blaine here that I think is an interesting one here that we haven't had before. And he's asking, are there any recurring clues in a company's financials about how management thinks about shareholders that you've noticed in the past?
Sure. I'm a big believer in shareholder letters. And, you know, managers that talk to you like a partner in the business, that in equal measure talk about things that are going right and things that aren't going as well, that's kind of consideration one in all of this. You know, I'll go back to my earlier comments. I mean, I'm always focused on debt. And, you know, companies that are indiscriminately adding debt and getting to dangerous leverage levels. And, you know, that number can vary by industry, certainly. But you know, if I think that's a telltale clue. And then, you know, I think related to that is just the capital allocation generally, but specifically around share repurchases. And, you know, we're really cognizant of, you know, managers where we think, you know, the shares are, by our estimation, are attractive and good valuation to the extent that a company would have excess cash flow that it could devote to share repurchase. We would consider that to be an extremely good thing. I mean, obviously, with every individual investment, you know, you want to scrutinize the notes, and you know, there can be things that can give you pause, but I wouldn't say that's universal, and I can't sort of point to, okay, here's the five things in the notes that are non-starters. But for sure, you want to look at that. And, you know, I think I'm pretty sure Buffett made a comment one time about, you know, if you want to make your financial statements understandable, you can. And so if you're reading through the notes and you're really having a tough time understanding what they're trying to get at, that may be a clue and something to take into account. So those would be the main things I would look for.
Definitely. Well, some good ideas there for our audience to consider moving forward in the future to keep an eye out for those things there. Jumping over now to our live chat questions as they've been rolling in. We do have a decent amount built up here. First one coming from Dale, as we've decided to call him. That's my best guess on the name here, and we're rolling with it here. Dale's one of our regular viewers here. We've had a little bit of an ongoing joke over how to pronounce their name, but we're going with Dale. First question right off the bat, he's poking right at the big headline gathering topic here, asking, what's your opinion on Chinese shares listed on the NASDAQ and the New York Stock Exchange? Some of these seem extremely attractive at this point in time, but could be dangerous at the same time.
That's a great question, Dale. And, you know, I don't have any particular insight for you, other than to say, you know, I do not believe that the Chinese government will behave deliberately, irrationally in a way that destroys the economic prospects for their company and or for their country, excuse me, for their country and you know, for their companies. And so, you know, there's been a lot of talk around, you know, demanding deregistration in the U.S. and pulling back to other markets. And, you know, I think that's going to ebb and flow, and that's certainly a possibility. I should tell you that we own one dual-listed Chinese company that's listed in both Hong Kong and in the NASDAQ or has a NASDAQ listing. And, you know, we bought the NASDAQ shares. You know, we'll see. I mean, as a global operation, if we ended up with Hong Kong shares, I mean, we could certainly handle that. I understand, you know, some investors, that can be problematic based on, you know, their brokerage accounts and their ability to execute on a global basis. But I don't have any particular insight other than to say, throughout my career, I've kind of tried to avoid these big philosophical questions. And, you know, we'll make enough mistakes trying to select good businesses, you know, and you know, if we find a good Chinese business that we think we can understand and we can understand the prospects for it, we're certainly going to buy that company regardless of where its exchange listing is.
Gotcha. I mean, fair enough there. Another question coming in here from WK. They're another one of our regular viewers here, asking specifically, and we hit on this before going live, but what features or tools do you like using on Guru Focus for your investment business? And then he asks a secondary follow-up question, which one do you like the most?
The first one's easy. The second part of the question, I want to think about that while I'm answering the first part. But, to be fair, when I first took out my Guru Focus subscription, I was mostly interested in, the aggregation of the data on what other investors I respect are doing and looking at that and, as a way of getting some ideas to research and think about. As time has gone on, I've become much more appreciative of the broader features of the platform. And, certainly I do use the financial data. I mean, we get data from other sources as well, but I do use that. It's a quick and easy way to get, a broad array of ratios laid out for you. I'm a big fan of the DCF calculator on the Guru Focus website. And I was saying to Graham, when we get down, or before we came on, when we get down to really looking at a company, in the final stages before go, no go. Yeah, we may bring our own DCF calculations to bear, but what I really love about the function on the website is the ability to take a company and just say, okay, what if the growth rate's 10? What if it's 8? What if it's 12? What if it's 3? Okay, what's the terminal growth rate? Is that happening in 5 years or 8 years or 10 years? Okay, is there a number that we're going to plug in? I mean, the default on Guru Focus is that tangible book value number. Oftentimes, we will just add a number. Typically, net cash perhaps is something that we like to add into that number. And I just find it a great way to sort of conceptually think about a business that you're looking at. And so, set another way on that DCF, if every assumption you're making and you're still coming out with a market price that's below that intrinsic value calculation under a wide range of assumptions, you're probably on to something. And so I really do like that function as well. And I will just say, and I said this to Graham earlier, every time you poke around on GuruFoot, you find something new. And I admit, each time I go back and spend some time with the platform, I'm always amazed at its robustness and the many different features. And so, I'll maybe defer on part two of the question. I've tried to give you a flavor for how I use it, other than to say I'm a big fan of the platform and I'm a big fan of Charlie's book and what Charlie's tried to create along with Graham and all the other colleagues at Guru Focus. I think it's terrific.
Oh, we definitely appreciate the kind words there, Jeff, and we're glad to hear that you're a fan of it. And obviously our audience here hopefully is a fan of it as well. So glad to see that we do have people using the platform and enjoying its services there. So continuing on down our list, moving on to our next question here, coming from the Jewish man, he is asking, are there any books that you highly recommend for our audience to read?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. I mean, I don't know if you can see the two bookshelves behind me, but they're filled to overflowing with investment books. So I'll maybe just start with a slight sidebar on that, and then I'll come back with some specific suggestions. I try to think about my reading in sort of multiple ways. People biographies about their careers and the businesses they've created, that's a mainstay. I'm a buyer of many, many books about, behavioral finance or behavioral principles and how do you trick yourself. Then, of course, like many of your viewers, Graham, you know, I love to read investment books, and I'm a big fan of both of what, well, Peter Lynch actually had three books. The third book that doesn't often get talked about, Learn to Earn, was really written for a child audience or a younger youthful audience that were just beginning to learn principles of investing. But, you know, certainly One Up on Wall Street and Beating the Street have to be in that cohort of must reads. Phil Fisher's books, Robert Hagstrom's books on Buffett. He's done a terrific job with them. A new one that I will happily tout, and I am only about 40% of the way through the book, but I just can't put it down, and would probably be reading it right now if I was not on this call, is called The Model, written by Richard Lawrence. The print copy, I believe, is not even yet available, but you can get an ebook version. And Richard Lawrence started and is a principal at a firm called Overlook Investing that invests solely in Asia. And that his firm has a terrific, terrific track record over 30 years. And he really wrote The Model to celebrate that 30 years. And it's a history of what they went through in Asia over the last 30 years. And he's just a very, very solid investor, and his colleagues are solid, and heartily endorse the book. So The Model, 37 years of investing in Asia, written by Richard Lawrence. Commend it to all your readers. Graham and Dodd certainly, an intelligent investor and security analysis have to be on that list. Books, I've read a few books about Sir John Templeton, The Templeton Touch, and certainly the Templeton Way, written by Lauren Templeton and her husband Scott, and great books about Sir John Templeton. So that's some. I know I've left a huge number off the list, but in the interest of time, I'll leave it at that.
All righty. Well, there you go, chat. Plenty of options for you if you need to do some good reading in the future. Continuing on down our list, we have a question coming in from FewTrack. He is asking, if you are building up cash, which you hinted at a little bit earlier in that presentation, what do you do with it? Do you hold it? Are you purchasing short-term bonds? Is there a plan there for it?
Again, I want to start by signaling that, cash isn't an active investment decision. It's a residual of what we do. Maybe you end up in the same spot, but I'm not necessarily signing on to, we're building cash because the market's expensive and we think it's going to go down. We don't know what the future holds for the market, and any cash we have is a residual. The other point that I think in our operation it's important to note is, we consider our event-driven investments as near cash. So, I mentioned Casper earlier, and, if all goes according to plan, and it may not, but if all goes according to plan, that takeover will be concluded no later than the end of the first quarter of 2022. So, you've got 90 days plus a little residual here in December. So, we'll often go into these event-driven investments as thinking about them in part as near cash. So right now, give or take, we actually only have, a 2 to 5% cash weighting, but we have an event-driven weighting that's over 20% of our portfolio. So if you kind of lump those two buckets together, we would think of cash and near cash as being, you know, 25 to 30%. And, you know, I'm not in any way suggesting that there's no risk with the event driven and you should think of the event driven like T-bills or something. Of course, there are specific risks associated with any event, but there is this notion of they roll over. And, you know, if you get a correction, and if being the key word here, because I have no idea, but if you get a correction and it's a normal correction as opposed to something like March of 20, where you were down, you know, 40% quickly. So without defining it precisely, down 10% in markets. Our experience has been that, you know, those event driven, the spreads may widen a little bit, but not a lot. And, you know, they have their own cycle and you go through to completion of the deal and then that money rolls over into cash. And so then you would have capital available for reinvestment. So I know that's not quite the way your questioner phrased the question. I mean, I just, we're not holding cash because we have a view about the future. We just hold cash when we can't find things to do, and our hope would be that we would find things to do. So at the risk of maybe dipping a toe into the water of market valuation, I will just comment that, you know, if interest rates stay down, no view being expressed, but if interest rates continue to stay low, I do think there's attractive things to do in the market. If interest rates go up, of course, that affects all valuations, whether that's real estate, farmland, private residences, the stock market, you know, so that's what you're confronted with. But again, you know, we've spent a long career saying if we can buy a good business that can grow at an above average rate, you know, over time at a discount or in a margin of safety, you know, we think that's your pathway home in an increasing interest rate environment. And I'll maybe just conclude, you know, Peter Lynch has said, you know, more money's lost preparing for corrections than in the corrections themselves. And, you know, that resonates with me. And we've just never been able to predict what's going to happen in markets with any sense of reliability. And so, again, you know, just have to pound the table hard on this. Our cash is a residual position, not a statement of view on what we're thinking.
Gotcha. So if I can sum it up in simple terms, cash happens, but you're not actively trying to collect cash for something in the future.
Said better than I said it in less time.
For sure. All righty. Well, looks like we have a couple questions here from Eric, another one of our usual viewers. And we did hit during the presentation on this first question here of him asking what type of metrics that you like to look at. You know, we hit a couple of those when jumping in through that strategy and philosophy there. And then he's also asking, which I think kind of lumps in here pretty well, but how do you value companies? Obviously, we hit on you using the DCF models. Is there anything else that you would kind of put in your, we'll call it a top five metrics or something along those lines that you like to use for that valuation?
Maybe I'll reverse engineer it. You know, show me a company that's consistently earned returns on equity, you know, above 20%, that hasn't levered itself inordinately to achieve those returns, so has minimal or no debt and net cash, that's selling for 10 times earnings or 10 times or less owner earnings or even 15 times in this low interest rate environment that we're in. where, you know, all those indicators are rear view mirror things. And then you swivel around and you look out the front mirror of the car or front window of the car and you say, okay, is there anything that I could see coming at me here that would lead me to believe the future's going to be radically different than the past? And if you can honestly answer that question that you can't point to anything, sure, that's an ideal type of investment for us. And, you know, oftentimes the mistakes we've made is that, you know, that aha moment, you know, wow, never saw that coming, you know, where you pivoted, you know, all looking through the rearview mirror, all the numbers were great. You know, you pivoted, you looked out the front window and you said, don't see anything negative coming at me. But then presto, all of a sudden, up pops something. And, you know, that's, clearly faulty analysis. And, you know, you just, this business is fascinating and fun and exciting because, you know, you're always learning from your mistakes and trying to make fewer mistakes. But I mean, maybe that's the best way to get at the question.
Definitely. Well, from what I'm gathering, there is no specific order for you of how you want to approach it, but you definitely have some considerations there.
Yeah.
And perfect segue as well, actually, to a question a little bit further down the list that we'll go ahead and skip to before we return to the earlier questions here. But another one coming here from the Jewish man, and he's asking you, what has been your biggest mistake and what did you learn from it?
Wow. How much time do you have? I guess would be my first response. I mean, I'll name a couple of names. You know, one that jumps to mind, a small company called, well, originally called Rainmaker Entertainment, now called WOW Unlimited Media. And, you know, I mean, even to a certain extent, you know, and I've listed Garrett on the screen here, and I think we'll come out of Garrett just fine. But, you know, the common themes there were leverage and your ability to handle leverage. And, you know, I guess I'm, as my career goes on, I'm becoming ever more vigilant around, you know, you can do all the cash flow analysis in the world and yeah, they'll be fine. And, you know, their coverages are great, but then, you know, something comes along that derails you. I mean, you know, Garrett's makes turbochargers for the auto business. And so, you know, the pandemic comes along and autos, you know, snapped shut overnight, you know, around the world. Well, it makes servicing that debt difficult. So those are, you know, there's other names that I could fill a book with, I'm sure. But, you know, the common theme, it seems to me, is always debt. By the way, I should say to you, I don't, there's been very, maybe one case, I'm just trying to think, but, you know, I tend to trust managements and what they tell you until proven otherwise. And I don't think I've ever really been fooled by a management team. Like either on the front end, you're able to identify some of those weaknesses, the usual, which is they really don't have any of their money up. But, you know, I know a lot talk about, you know, appraising management and judging management. And of course, that's very, very important. But, you know, I can only think of perhaps one circumstance where I felt I was deliberately misled by management. So, yeah, debt, like the common theme is always debt, in my opinion.
For sure. And on the note of management, they're a little bit of innocent until proven guilty, I'm gathering from you here.
Yeah, for sure.
All righty. Well, I guess while we're on the tough topics, Mike is going to put you on the spot here. once again, as the Jewish man just did, and he prefaced his question with his research has shown that your funds seem to have underperformed since inception, and he would like to know, how do you attract investors with those types of returns? He's, like I said, putting it on the spot here. What's the, I guess, the marketing speak that's coming from you?
Well, first of all, I'll just acknowledge your question, the question, and say, yeah, that's absolutely true. And we don't try to hide from that or deflect from that. But I do think that it is important to highlight that, you know, performance since inception is endpoint sensitive. And, you know, we went through a period that lasted about 5 years up until a year ago, where, yeah, we were out of step with conditions and markets. And, you know, for the first 15 to 18 years of our firm's existence, we actually had market beating returns. And so our poor performance up until about a year to 18 months ago, certainly hurt us. We're steadily closing the gap. My intention is that we will close that gap in its entirety and pull again, ahead again, just as we have for a big part of our future. In terms of attracting clients specifically, I just think you have, if you have a track record of integrity and honesty and fair dealing, and by the way, disclosure when times aren't good, people recognize that for what it is. And I think people in our case also recognize that for a good part of our history, we did outperform markets, and they're viewing this perhaps as more of an opportunity than a problem to either add additional capital if their existing investors with us, or if they haven't been investors with us, but they've studied the story for a long time, you know, they're saying, I think the time is right. So, fully acknowledge what your questioner's saying. And yeah, we went through a very, very difficult time, that ended, let's say, kind of the end of or midpoint to endpoint of 2019. I mean, yes, 2020 is what it is, but, you know, we've come back a long way. And, ask the question again in a few years. And, you know, certainly there's no guarantees, and we may have the same track record at that point, but I would like to think it's going to look different. And, you know, at the end of the day, we had a long track record of achieving that and did achieve that. And after all fees and expenses and all those considerations, I think we were very tax efficient in how we went about it. I think there's things you can point to that would lead you to a possible conclusion that where we are at today is not indicative of where we might be at in the future, and certainly where, factually speaking, we were at in the past. So, but great question. And you know, one of the hard parts of the investment business is having these periods of time where you're underperforming, and it's not fun, and it's not fun for us, and it's not fun for our investors. But you know, head down, keep working hard, and that's what we're doing.
Definitely. And you know, as you mentioned, we do appreciate that level of honesty coming out here, and we'll call it bearing your soul for us. And you know, when it comes down to the end of things, you can't win them all, right?
Yeah.
Well, we do have a few more questions here lined up for us. And I'm sure our audience will roll out a little bit more as they know we're getting towards the end of things here. They like to toss out those last-minute questions at us. One coming here from Vindu. He is asking, how do you know, and this hints a little bit at some of the avoidance that we've had on questions earlier, but how do you know if a stock is in a bubble and you want to ride it out before a collapse? I know this is a big prediction question, but I guess speak to it to the best of your ability here.
Huh. Well, obviously, great question. And if anybody has that crystal ball that has accuracy, please feel free to let me know. Graham, the first part of the question is being rigorous about, you know, your intrinsic value estimates. So, you know, to state the obvious, I guess, if you're still trading at a discount to intrinsic, you know, I'm likely not to be a seller based on trying to predict the future vis-a-vis stock market corrections. Now, I think a very real aspect of portfolio management is risk management. So, you know, where you can run into problems is, you know, you just have something that's a very large weight in your portfolio. Your tools of analysis still say it's below intrinsic value, but, you know, surprises happen and things, you know, the future's not predictable. And so I think a very real way that we try to manage money, and we probably candidly learned this one the hard way, is, you know, when something gets above 10%, I'm not saying we automatically rigorously cut it back, but boy, we're certainly thinking about, you know, how, like, what, you know, what if something goes wrong here that's unexpected? So, you know, that's something we try to think about. But, you know, the other comment that I would make, and maybe this goes back to, you know, the end point in time on our performance numbers. I mean, my experience says ride it out. You know, if you think you're right on the facts and you have an understanding of what you own and why you own it, you know, my tendency is to ride those things out. So, you know, that's how we tend to think about, you know, when to sell type decisions. And mostly, you know, it's guided by our intrinsic value. But secondly, it's maybe guided by the art of portfolio management and how large of a weight is something in your portfolio at the time. And does it make sense to just trim some because you're at that point where if something unexpected goes wrong, it's really going to hurt. So those are the kinds of things that we try to think about.
Understood. And I think that's you kind of hit on it there at the end here, but our final question in our list currently was asking what your sell strategy looks like and when do you choose to sell a stock and why?
Yeah. Not much to add to what I didn't say in the prior question, but I mean, above all else, and practically speaking, you know, if you're being very conservative with your intrinsic value estimates, which we certainly try to be, we may have failed from time to time, but we certainly try to be, I would argue that just hitting intrinsic value, I mean, if you felt you built in you were quite conservative in terms of that estimate, that in and of itself may not, okay, we've reached that number. And you know, by definition, that's a range, not a single number. But, you know, you may not be a seller solely in that circumstance. But certainly the further you go above your estimate of intrinsic value, the more likely a sale decision is triggered. And then, you know, just to build on what I said before, the other key thing is just trying. I mean, I'm a believer in concentrated portfolios, but, you know, the And I think we run, by anybody's definition, a concentrated portfolio. But the issue with, you know, and I'm just picking a number, a five-stock portfolio, you know, is you better make sure that your investors are also aligned to accept that level of volatility. And if they are, that's great. And that's certainly your best five ideas will be better than your best 10 ideas. And so that's not an invalid way to manage things. But where I've seen things go bad for money managers in the public money management business is where, you know, if you don't have alignment with your investors, or you think you have alignment, but you turn out not to have alignment and they flee from you at inopportune times, that certainly impacts your long run results. And so that's something to think about. So in our case, and again, I'm not saying universally that this is how everybody should think, but in our case, you know, the minute we get up at 10 or above 10, like that's when, you know, our radar goes on in terms of, should we be thinking about a risk management decision here that can be independent of that intrinsic value estimate decision? So don't know if that helps or not, Graham. It's some ways a restatement of what I said earlier, but maybe add a little bit more color to it.
Definitely. No, I think great answer there, and I think that'll be a great place for us to kind of end on here today. So before we close out, I just want to say thank you, Jeff, for joining us today. It's been an absolute pleasure. Great presentation, great interaction here with the audience. We really do appreciate you coming on.
Well, thank you so much, Graham, and it's been a pleasure. And, you know, if there were some questions that were left that, you know, you want to send my way, I could perhaps respond offline to you and you could get answers back to the questioners. But thank you for listening, everyone. Thank you for all the good work that you do, Graham, and the people at Guru Focus, and just was happy to do this, and maybe look forward to doing it again in the future.
Absolutely. And for those of you out there in the audience, if you missed anything from Jeff today, you do want to tune back in. There will be a full recap of this live stream here on YouTube momentarily, as well as on Guru Focus. And for those of you that might not be the most inclined to watch a video, we've actually started uploading our Value Investing Live series as a podcast. You can find it anywhere on Spotify, Google, and Apple. So keep an eye out for those episodes coming in the future. As we're rounding things out here, I'll wish everyone the best and hopefully see some strong returns out there in 2022. Hey everyone, thanks for listening to this episode of Value Investing Live. If you haven't joined one of our live streams before, check us out on YouTube and register for the events on gurufocus.com. If it's your first time hearing of us, click the link in the bio for a free 7-day trial of Guru Focus, where you can test out all of our great tools and features. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.